I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Ukraine crisis. Professor Stephen F. Cohen of New York University, Princeton University, Russian History Emeritus joins me to discuss not the Ukraine crisis in exclusively, but the contest between the West and the East. These are old adversaries from the Cold War of the 20th century. And yet so many of the senior figures in leadership in Moscow and Washington and Brussels and London and all the capitals of Europe were younger people during the Cold War. And the tropes are recognizable. So are the prejudices. Steve, a very good evening to you. I go to headlines from Ukraine just to say that the fighting has not started again, although the violations are routine. Hundreds of explosions reported by the OSCE, the monitoring unit from the Minsk II agreements, but no one launching operations across the general line, the Donbass ceasefire line. Major weapons could be underway, but we do not see tank units charging into Mariupol, or on the other hand, the National Guard units now being trained in Western Ukraine by the U.S. and other NATO forces. They have not launched any offensives against the Donbass rebels. So the larger story here is, in the springtime, with good fighting weather in front of us, how the major states are regarding this conflict. And you know there's a piece in Moscow Times right now speaking to a man, Christopher Hill, who's a veteran State Department a senior figure who is reflecting upon the Ukraine crisis in an interview. And what he, Christopher Hill, points to is that the Ukraine crisis is an illustration of the breakdown of international order. He calls it the Westphalian order. This is the understanding, the foundation, that sovereignty is to be acknowledged at all times, and that violation of sovereignty is a break with the way the laws, the international community conducts itself. Mr. Hill points especially to the annexation of Crimea, but he also mentions that during the 20th century, the Clinton administration, the Serbian conflict was a breakdown in the Westphalian order, the violation of sovereignty there. And he points to the South China Sea now, where China is grabbing the Paracel Islands and other small built-up islands to encroach upon the sovereignty of its neighbors. So the understanding that we have of Ukraine right now is that Russia has broken the international community's understanding, presumption of order. Do you find that accurate, Professor? A very good evening to you.
I don't find it accurate, but I think the first thing you said is worth emphasizing, because it reminds us what the moment is. Returning to the ceasefire, it's true, both sides are shooting at the other. It's also true that neither side has mobilized an offensive. They've respected the territorial agreement made at Minsk back in February. But that said, let me put it differently, very loud and authoritative voices in Kiev, in Washington, and in Brussels, the headquarters of NATO, are saying almost daily that a larger war is coming and coming soon. Now, each blames the other. Kiev and Washington and Brussels are saying that Russia is going to launch this war. But Moscow is warning that all this war talk is preparation for a U.S. Kiev-backed assault on eastern Ukraine. And the appearance of American, Canadian, and U.K. trainers, as they're called, to train Ukrainian fighters, the National Guard, makes Moscow think that this, too, is part of the preparation. There are also reports, can't verify them, but a lot of them, that weapons are pouring in not only into the rebel territories, we hear that every day from Russia, but into Kiev territory. So it is fully possible that both sides are beefing up for a showdown. That said, it sometimes distracts us from the larger picture that Hill gives us in this interview, which I don't know if it appeared outside the Moscow Times. I don't know how widely it's been read, but he sees a world coming apart, not only as a result of Ukraine and the crisis, but of things other great powers have been doing, including the United States and China. And he puts it in this context of the Westphalian order. But that doesn't seem to me to be useful, because surely the Westphalian order, which said that you had to respect another state's sovereignty, and you wouldn't attempt to change territorial borders by force, that's been violated a jillion times over the centuries. And if we just look at the 20th century, it was plunged into the abyss by World War I and World War II. So if we come now to the post-Soviet order, beginning 25 years ago in 1991, I would reformulate what Hill said as follows, that the West is accusing Russia under Putin of destroying the post-Soviet order, security order, in Europe. By having, I guess, annexed Ukraine and arming the fighters in Donbass, in eastern Ukraine. So if we're going to say, when did this begin? And Hill is very honest about this. He doesn't just blame Russia. He points to what we did in 1999, if we just stick with the post-1991 order. He then points to what Russia did in Georgia in 2008. And then to Russia, Crimea today, but then he mentioned Chinese maneuvers in its waters seem to be part of the same thing. So if you're ascribing blame on the basis of cause and effect, it begins with the American air invasion of Serbia. But there's one other point that's exceedingly important, and people don't either remember it, or they don't understand it, or they're concealing it. To say that Putin is destroying the post-Soviet order created in Europe after the end of the Soviet Union neglects to mention that Russia was purposefully excluded from that order. It was never invited to join what became the NATO order in Europe as NATO expanded from Berlin all the way to Russia's borders. So Putin's response could be, though he hasn't said this, you're accusing me of destroying something that I protested all along because you left me out. The larger point that Hill makes, though, I think, is valid, that we talk each week about micro events and many macro events emanating from the Ukrainian crisis, but we're living through a geopolitical transition, and to what we do not know, but the world will not again be the way it looked 5 or 6 years ago, at least in Europe. So these are really historic times, and the epicenter is Ukraine. The essential confrontation is between the United States and Russia. But on the parallel line, Europe is splitting over this. China is reorienting itself. So if not global, it's certainly semi-global.
I'm speaking to Professor Stephen F. Cohen of New York University, Princeton University, Russian History Emeritus. We're looking at Ukraine crisis, but now we've turned to the understanding of the international community and a sense of order. The question here that Mr. Hill, we're referring to the Moscow Times interview, also takes on is, what is Russia's goal in Ukraine? What is Russia's goal along the Russian frontier? Is it to bring back, in the Soviet terms, a world dominated by Soviet economics, Soviet civic affairs? Or is it instead to build a regional sphere of influence, something that reaches back 100 years to the great powers and the Entente? And when we come back, what does Professor Cohen believe is Moscow's goal in Ukraine? I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Professor Stephen F. Cohen of New York University is here, and we're discussing Ukraine crisis. But from the point of view of an interview with Christopher Hill, a senior American State Department official who looks to be offering even-handed criticism of the breakdown of international order, evidenced by Crimea, yes, but also evidenced by Serbia in the 20th century and China's moves in the South China Sea here in the 21st century. Steve, the Hill concession is that Russia is not looking to impose Soviet Marxism or Russian capitalism on the world. It's looking for regional spheres of influence. What does that mean? And does that, to you, strike you as a worthy goal for all of this turmoil?
Well, I think Hill is absolutely right about the first part. There is absolutely no evidence that Russia is seeking to recreate the Soviet Union as a geopolitical phenomenon. None whatsoever. It doesn't have the resources. It doesn't have the ideology. It doesn't have the inclination. It doesn't have popular support. And the leaders have another mission in mind. They are busy. And I've mentioned this to you before, John, rebuilding at home the Russian state that collapsed in 1991. That's only 25 years ago, and the collapse ramified everywhere. So the core mission of Putin, his historical mandate written in the wind, so to speak. And by the way, on Sunday night, just a couple nights ago, there was a remarkable Russian television documentary. I so wish it could be shown with subtitles in this country, where Putin, for almost 2 hours, so about an hour and a half of it, of interview with Putin, talked about his mission as president during these 15 years. And it's absolutely clear that that was his mission, to rebuild Russia at home. Now, we can debate what kind of state he's hoping to rebuild at home. But it includes, and here's where I would only disagree with the language that Hill uses, I would not say that Russia wants a sphere of influence, unless we're talking about trade influence, which every nation seeks. I would say that what Russia wants and is now demanding and will go to war for is a zone of security. I prefer that formulation, which means no foreign military bases on its borders, which means Ukraine at the moment and Georgia, because NATO is now moving, as we talk, again against Georgia, trying to bring Georgia into NATO. It is really that simple, that Russia wants to trade with the world east and west. Why wouldn't it? It sits between east and west. That's what it's proposed all along. That's good for the Russian economy. Militarily, however, it wants security in the form of no military bases on its borders. Moreover, spheres of influence in military terms, which is kind of an 18th, 19th century concept, are utterly, totally obsolete. Missiles can fly 6 minutes or less, 3 minutes across an entire sphere of influence. There's no defense against them in that sense. And that's why, by the way, that Russia is adamantly protesting the United States and NATO building missile defense right on Russia's border. So it wants these areas on its border militarily, put it differently, free of military threat. Personally, I think that's entirely reasonable. And we take what's a cliche, but it's a meaningful one. What if Russian or Chinese military bases showed up in Mexico and or Canada? We would object very, very adamantly, maybe go to war over it. We threatened to do so when the Soviet Union put missiles in Cuba. So it seems to me a benign, healthy, modern-day position that no great power wishes to have foreign military bases on its borders. Now, everybody says that's true in the West, except when it comes to Russia, because we've expanded NATO to Russia's borders, and now Russia's pushing back.
You look at a map, Steve, and you see where Ukraine is, you see where Donbass is and Crimea and how it was part of the Soviet state and the Russian Empire until a period where Khrushchev handed it off from about 60 years ago. You look at the map and you see that protecting your borders includes having some confidence that there will not be an enemy power who can cross your frontier and influence decisions, political decisions in the country. Now, Russia has a vast border. This particular fight on Ukraine, it is a piece of a larger story of the encroachment of NATO marching ever eastward since the end of the Cold War. Was that debate underway between Washington and Moscow before the Obama administration, before Ukraine crisis, reaching back to the Clinton years, that NATO itself is an organization that was founded on threatening Moscow, and that moving it ever eastward does not reach, let's put it this way, it's not friendly. Is that debate, did that debate happen, and who won the debate?
The debate happened with Russia largely behind closed doors. Yeltsin, the president of Russia in the 1990s, had put himself, by virtue of his psychology, his failing health, and his collapsed economy, in the position of being a kind of supplicant of the United States. So when Clinton decided in the second half of the 1990s to move NATO eastward, not all at once, because Bush then carried on the expansion, but to begin the eastward movement of NATO, Yeltsin did protest privately, And he was told, well, why would you protest? This is no longer a military organization. This is about political democracy. So it'll be good for you. And in addition, maybe you'll join NATO one day. This was all eyewash, of course. We have enough archival information to know that driving NATO expansion was a number of factors, including the desire of small countries formerly in the Soviet sphere of influence to be in NATO. But there was also in Washington a view that Moscow was down and it should be kept down, and the way you keep it down was to move NATO eastward. Now, it also had to do with Germany, I think. But there was a strong group here in the United States debating against the Clinton administration that this was really unwise, that this was a rooster that would come home to roost, as it has now. So whether it was, it was clearly an unwise decision, though there's, by the way, I say that clearly, but you're getting at the moment because people are asking the question in light of Ukraine, was this a good idea expanding NATO? You're getting maybe a dozen in the last 2 or 3 weeks, very prominent people who were associated with the decision to expand NATO, writing long articles about what a great success it is. That's probably a separate discussion. Was NATO expansion a success or not? But here's a point that links the two to conversation.
We have about a minute. Go ahead, Steve.
You and I, you as much as I, we equally have noted and discussed that Europe, Western Europe, the our transatlantic partner, the countries of NATO, is splitting over what to do about this Ukrainian crisis.
Right.
And that a number of them, particularly Germany, France, and Italy, are now objecting to the very, very non-accommodationist with Russia hard line. It's quite remarkable that in the Washington Post on April 25, what was that, 3 days ago, the man who used to be for many years its international correspondent, Jim Hoagland, he's in retirement, but he writes now frequently, occasionally, and he filed from Europe, I think, and here's a sentence he wrote. NATO is now, in fact, divided into three factions on Ukraine. So stop and think what that means. You and I have been saying that Europe is divided. Hoagland, who lives there, and by the way, is very pro-NATO, he's alarmed about this, tells us in the Washington Post, NATO itself is now divided into three factions on what to do about Ukraine. So this takes us back to Hill's argument that the structure of at least Europe built in recent years is coming unstuck as we talk, including NATO.
Professor Stephen Cohen, I'm John Batchelor. We'll be right back. This is the John Batchelor Show. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Professor Stephen F. Cohen of New York University, Princeton University, Russian History Emeritus. We're discussing Ukraine crisis in terms of view of the Westphalian assumptions of sovereignty being recognized. That's the 20th century, the 19th century, and here in the 21st century, also the idea of spheres of influence. Or in this particular case, does NATO threaten Moscow to the point that it needs to rearm and build up its conventional forces all along the Russian frontier? But there's other war fighting to follow the argument in Washington besides the tanks. There's also propaganda. And Steve, you mentioned the tribute or the documentary about Vladimir Putin on Russian television that we're not going to get to see in the United States, nor the candor that Putin conveys in the Russian language. I mentioned to you that Congress is paying a great deal of attention, so much so they're moving legislation now to start up what looks to be an alternative propaganda source from the United States. And in an article in The Guardian, Andrew Weiss, former director for Russian, Ukrainian, and Eurasian Affairs on the White House National Security Staff, has indicated that pro-Kremlin messaging not only includes Russia, but also Europe, sympathetic business leaders who have ties to Moscow. And he's pointing to the fact, the necessity of starting up an alternative service. Here's the quote. The Russian government tries to play off anti-Americanism, which remains a significant force, as well as to use the well-oiled and tested machinery of influence peddling and mutual commercial benefits to promote its cynical view of how the international system should work. In some countries, particularly in Eastern Europe or Central Europe, these forces are very powerful. In other words, Steve, what the United States now sees, and members of Congress see it as well, and they're looking for financing, is that the United States is in a propaganda war with Vladimir Putin himself. Is that accurate, Steve? Do you see that? Do you see Putin speaking of this in this documentary on Russian television?
But what's new here, John? I mean, we lived through a Cold War, which was, fortunately, more propaganda war than an actual war. We had ideological agencies and fronts and government-financed radio stations and books being published and smuggled across borders and all the rest. I mean, we've been through this before. The only thing new now is the Internet. This stuff flies around in greater quantity with great speed. Can't say the qualities of much. But Andrew Weiss, I know him. He's a nice fellow, but it's a kind of silly argument. Last time I checked, the United States spent approximately, I may be off on this, $1 billion a year on what the Russians would call our propaganda agencies. That's everything from Radio Marti, which broadcast into Cuba, to Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and a number of others that broadcast in English and in Russian into Russia. These are government-operated agencies that present, sometimes they do some decent reporting, but generally they present our point of view. And Russia has RT, the international, they say it's like CNN, but their international news television in English, Arabic, Spanish, I think, maybe one other. They're very, very big in hotels. They're bigger than CNN in hotels. They're in the United States. You can watch them on Time Warner, for example, but it's not widely watched. But it's a good, slick television operation, combination of hard news and what we call propaganda. But what's new here? I mean, we did it before. We're doing it again. My own view is better a propaganda war than a shooting war. But, you know, you got two colliding narratives now. Moscow presents one. We present the other. And the question is, which is correct? Or are both correct? And if both are correct, then we could have some compromise.
Well, Vladimir Putin's at the center of the stage in both operas. On one hand, he's a hero. I believe he's got an 80% plus
86
approval.
86%
plus. What's with the other 14%? What are they not paying attention? And then on the other hand, he is the new villain who is cited routinely by both parties. And you know, Steve, in the United States of America, the Democrats and the Republicans don't even butter their bread in the same fashion. And yet, Vladimir Putin is the enemy of both parties, all agreed upon members of Congress. There are a couple of voices who are dissenting, but they're not given any time whatsoever on the national media. So Vladimir Putin is the star in both. Does he like that, Steve? Is he welcoming this kind of attention?
Well, where to begin? First of all, you're absolutely right. I think we talked about this before. This is unlike during the latter decades of the Cold War. Neither Khrushchev nor Brezhnev nor later Andropov nor Chernenko were demonized, vilified personally the way Putin now is.
No, they were mocked, in fact, and Chernenko especially was regarded as sclerotic and ridiculous.
And Brezhnev also during his last years. And the importance of that is that this towering demonization of Putin has made it very hard to do the kind of analysis of Russian politics we did during the Cold War, and to think analytically about foreign policy. Everything's now the demon of Putin. You can't make any compromises. He's probably like Hitler and the rest. It's completely false. But if I could have a wish, I would have a national television network show with subtitles, two brilliantly made, because Russians really know how to make documentaries, films, about 2 hours each, that have been shown in Russia within the last 2 months. The first one was called The Road to Crimea, and it was about the history of the Russian decision to annex, or as Russia says, reunify with Crimea. And the centerpiece of that film is about an hour and a half interview with Putin. Then we have the film shown this Sunday night, devoted to Putin's 15 years. It's an anniversary now. He became president in March, I think, 2000, so it's 15 years. And it's about Putin more than anything else, and Putin and Russia. There are many interesting moments, and I think if Americans were able to watch this film, see Putin responding with a lot of brilliant footage, it's quite an exciting film. There's fighting and people jumping out of airplanes and all the rest. If people could watch that, it would do something to reduce this demonization. But the most striking thing that Putin said to me was, And this has harmed him in Russia. There's been commentary about this since Sunday night, a lot of it. He said, in effect, when I came to power, I was full of illusions about the West. I thought they would embrace Russia because we were no longer ruled by the Communist Party. And I was wrong. They continued to behave as they always behaved because they were not animated by anti-communism. They were animated by geopolitical ambition. And they wanted a Russia that was a supplicant nation, a Russia that needed help, a Russia on its back. And the moment, he said, that Russia began to rise from its knees, and he meant under his leadership, 14, 15 years ago, the West began to turn against this. Now, think what it is. How often has a leader, especially one in Putin's position, said while he's in power, I was full of illusions? Can you imagine an American president saying that? And in fact, he was widely criticized in Russia, in the newspapers, and there was a particular nuance here. How could a man who had spent his early career in the KGB as an intelligence officer with the opportunity to read a lot of classified things have any illusions at all? He must have been a lousy intelligence officer. This was commented on in the Russian press, but it was quite an admission, and I think the way he did it was to explain why he has evolved personally from a man who sought a full partnership with Washington and with Europe, and even suggested that Russia itself might join NATO, to the man who's now drawn a line in the sand, it's not sand, in Ukraine. So much so that Western policy, or depending on whom you think is responsible, may have brought us to the edge of the war. Because during 15 years, as a national security leader, Putin has changed profoundly. And he admitted it, and he explained it. And he says, basically, I had a weakness, and it was called illusion about the West.
Vladimir Putin does not have the same relationship with the leaders of Europe that he does with the leaders of the United States, which is to say no relationship whatsoever right now. Does he comment about his working relationship with Merkel, for example? They speak in Russian and German. I understand they speak in Russian when they're together because she learned that as a child. Does he comment about Cameron or Hollande or the other leaders of Europe as opposed to a Mr. Obama?
Let me be honest. The film is 2.5 hours long, and I've only watched half of it.
Okay.
I only got the link last night, and I don't know. But it's a very interesting moment in the part of the film I did watch. I had kind of forgotten about this, that not long after he became Russian leader, he went to Germany, and he addressed the German parliament in fluent German.
Mm-hmm.
Stop and think what that would mean. I mean, just think about it a minute. By the way, it turns out he also speaks rather decent English. This is a, how to put it, culturally sophisticated man. I mean, this is a man who knows things, who can read things for himself. Equally important, though, is something that his foreign minister said, that's Sergei Lavrov, in an almost, even more, I would say, wide-ranging interview that he gave Russian television and radio. That was, I think, on April 22. And he was asked what he thinks is behind Western policy in Ukraine, American policy, because it's viewed now in Moscow as an American policy, not a European policy. And Lavrov, the foreign minister, flat out said, from the beginning, it's all been about splitting Russia and Germany. That Washington was fearful of the growing economic and political rapprochement between Berlin and Moscow, something you and I talked about over the years, John.
2009, right after that embassy by Mr. Obama and Ms. Clinton to Moscow, right after that, I was told Medvedev went right to Berlin and sat down with Merkel, and that began a rapprochement that is historic, Steve. That reaches back centuries. These two have been at war many times, and that was the beginning of a conversation we see ongoing, Berlin and Moscow working as allies.
But an amendment here. Between the wars they fought, the two world wars that Germany and Russia fought, there were long periods when culturally, economically, and politically, they were close allies. That's a separate story, but it's a well-known fact to any diplomatic historian. So it is what we call, tritely, a love-hate relationship. But in the modern day, when you and I start speaking first, I think, about the geopolitics of American-Russian relations, this would have been 3 or 4 years ago at least, I said then, and I was writing then, that Russia's two most important bilateral relationships were with Beijing and Berlin. Washington was not high on the scale. The only thing Moscow needed from Washington was nuclear security. All the rest it could get from China and Germany. But Lavrov flatly said, and it was kind of not terribly diplomatic for one of the world's great diplomats, so it means they believe it, that this whole Ukrainian policy by the United States is to split Germany and Russia, which, to some extent, they have done. They have been successful. Germany, for example, has joined in the sanctions. But now Germany's pushing back. Merkel's trying to, through Minsk, to repair the rift, the split with Russia. And perhaps, I'm sure Lavrov thinks this, for that very reason, Washington is not the friend of the Minsk Accords, which Merkel brokered. By the way, for what it's worth, you know, there's this man, George Friedman, at what's it called?
Stratfor.com, yes.
Yeah. And he's written at length that he thought that American policy toward Ukraine was driven primarily by the desire to prevent any kind of rapprochement between Germany and Russia. And so the view is that people who sit around and do this for a living, and we don't know what they smoke or they drink because they get a little Dr. Strangelovey on us, but in their minds, the great nightmare is not an axis or an alliance between Moscow and Beijing, which, by the way, is now unfolding, but an axis between Moscow and Berlin because of their romantic strategic concept of the transatlantic alliance. If Berlin is gone, what's left of the alliance?
I have a statement by the foreign minister of Germany when we come back. This is Frank-Walter Steinmeier about Ukraine and Russia and the future. Professor Stephen F. Cohen, New York University, Princeton University, Russian History Emeritus. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Professor Stephen F. Cohen commenting upon the working relationship underway between Berlin and Moscow and Ukraine crisis interrupting this last year plus. However, Steve, I have a statement since you asked. Just recently, what is said to be a leaked letter by the German foreign minister, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, to the European Commission President Jean-Paul Juncker, saying that the European Union needs to, quote, ease Russian concerns. He goes on to say, and this seems like a practical statement, but in any event, because of the delicacy of these matters, I guess this leaked letter is revelation. The minister says that economic stability in Ukraine can hardly succeed without the participation of Russia. And he called for, quote, pragmatic political approaches without preconditions. Now, this is a leaked letter. You don't know. Politicians have a way of posturing in public and making it look like the leaked letter is talking out of school. But I would say that the German foreign minister, who on occasion has been held out as dismissive of Moscow in this conflict, is talking common sense, Steve. And if the foreign minister says this in Berlin, what is Paris? What is Rome? What is London not to follow along?
And what are the Germans telling Kiev and Washington? And we know now, a day or two ago, maybe three, the man in charge of European Union expansion, not NATO expansion, but EU, that's the economic aspect of this expansion, said that the European Union would take in no new members for at least 10 years. That just left Ukraine out in the cold. Remember that the whole Maidan uprising, the whole political conflict in Kiev over trade agreements was about bringing Kiev into the European Union. So we've had 14 months of war and death and destruction, and the disruption of the international order, probably irreparable, and the end result is, never mind, we can't be taking you in. Now, you know why they don't want to take Kiev in. It was a basket case 14 months ago. Now it's an economic cemetery. But it was an emphatic statement. But look, about Russia. we don't need specialists to tell us two important facts. Russia, for decades, has been Ukraine's single largest, by far, trading partner. That's point one. Point two, 3 to 4 million Ukrainians work in Russia on work permits in order to send their salaries back home to support their families in Ukraine. There's no work in Ukraine. If Russia decides to send them home, it would be a terrible blow to Ukraine. And third, for all its bravado, Ukraine has lived on discounted Russian energy for decades and on the transit fees it's received from Russia, billions of dollars a year, for transiting, for shipping Russian energy through your Ukraine to Western Europe. All of that now is in the gravest of jeopardy. Russia is still Ukraine's, after war even, a year of war, largest trading partner. Those 3 or 4 million Ukrainian citizens still work in Russia. But Medvedev, the prime minister, has said, we may send them home if this doesn't stop. And on the question of energy, as you know, Putin has now said that by the year 2019, I think in 4 years, no Russian energy will flow through Ukraine. They're going to send it through this terminal that they're hoping to build in Turkey and Greece. So Ukraine is losing everything. It's losing everything from this. And without Russia, Ukraine cannot survive economically. This is just a fact. I mean, blame whomever you will, but it's been a fact for decades. Why anybody would have wanted to put Ukraine in such jeopardy, economic jeopardy, by alienating Russia the way it has, with American backing? This is a folly, and for which I think historians will really severely condemn the policymakers who are behind
it. We have less than 30 seconds, Steve, so I just want to flag that the time of greatest concern for reigniting of the conflict is around the victory parade in Moscow on May 9th, and we'll speak of the significance of this and the upset of the Russian people being insulted by having leaders of the West not attending the victory parade, and how Russia contributed to the success of the Second World War and the 20th century, and how that is being left out of American history books these last decades. Professor Stephen F. Cohen, New York University and Princeton University, Russian History, Ukraine Crisis. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show.